as a way that each of us lives our lives, as we face the struggles that we go through, imagining the processes that we see around us all the time. This sense of duality. Now, it may just be worth pointing out here that if we reflect back to what I was saying in the previous lecture on the emergence of exclusive monotheism among the Hebrews, and the fact that this produces for Western civilization one powerful but challenging tradition, the notion of thinking in ones, in monads. It's very hard to think in ones. Very hard indeed. It's much easier to think in twos, perhaps easier still to think in manys, polys, polytheists, many gods. But at the very least, two seems somehow a superior way of imagining the world, at least for some, than to think in terms of strict unities. Now, Zoroaster himself, Zarathustra, was very much more interested in the spiritual realm than in the earthly, in the temporal, in what we see around us. This again will be a very powerful part of later philosophical and religious traditions. All right? We'll see this, for example, particularly in connection with Plato. But there is this insight, and we find it in Zarathustra, and I don't want to suggest later, for example, that Plato was somehow a closet Zoroastrian. That's not the point. But people are arriving at fairly common understandings of problems. The world as I see it, as I look out at it, is messy and confusing and troubling and complicated. Surely there is a world beyond this one that is better, that is clearer, that is more easy to understand. And perhaps this world is somehow but a false impression of that other realm. You see? Very interesting to think of the superiority of the spiritual realm to the temporal realm in which we live. But these dualisms, I must emphasize once more, are going to come back again and again and again. We're going to meet them with people called Manichaeans in the time of the Roman Empire. We're going to meet them as people called Bogomils. You probably haven't been thinking much about Bogomils lately, but, 20 or so lectures on, I'll invite you to think about Bogomils. We're going to meet them as Cathars. We're going to meet them as people in the south of France called Albigensians. So these dualists who trace a direct legacy to Zoroaster are an impressive and important part of the Western tradition. So what's the legacy of this imperial age? Well, the Assyrians and the Babylonians built some impressive buildings, but didn't otherwise leave much else behind. They were not the kind of people who were going to leave much behind. As I said before, these were bad guys. The Persians, on the other hand, left a legacy of civilized rule. They left a particular way of thinking about government and about kingship, and they left a profound religious heritage that interacted reciprocally and fruitfully with Judaism, with Christianity, and later with Islam. Well, I mentioned several times that the Persians bumped into the Greeks. In our very next lecture, we ourselves will bump into the Greeks.
Lecture 6, Wide Ruling Agamemnon.
Hello again, and welcome to the 6th lecture in our series on the foundations of Western civilization. You may recall that at the end of the last lecture, I said we're now going to bump into the Greeks, and so we shall. Now, if I said you were born in Greece, you'd probably say, no, I wasn't. I was born in Punxsutawney or someplace. But for a very long time, intellectuals were in the habit of saying, you were born in Greece. The fundamental notion being that somehow the Western tradition was born there, and that there is a straight line from then until now. Now, we have spent some time looking at people who lived before the Greeks, or, as we'll see in this lecture, contemporaneously with the Greeks, because the Greeks learned things from these people. That's one reason to study them. And because some of them made, as, for example, with Zoroastrianism, as, for example, with Phoenician commerce and colonies, as, for example, with Hebrew religious ideas, some of these people made durable contributions of their own. But now we come to the Greeks, and we'll occupy ourselves with the Greeks over the next several lectures from a number of different points of view. But to get the story started, we must say that civilization in the Greek world began on the Mediterranean island of Crete, lying off the Greek mainland, about 2000 BC. Again, nothing terribly sacred about that date, but that's approximately when we really see civilization taking its rise there. So a bit later than, for example, in the Near East. Now, this civilization that arose on the island of Crete, we have always called, well, always for the last couple of centuries, Minoan, from the legendary king Minos, whose palace, may or may not have been his palace, actually, but whose great palace was found on the island of Crete. So Minoan civilization attaches to the name of Minos, the legendary king. Now, legend not only attaches to Minos and mystery, it attaches to much else about Minoan civilization. For example, we don't know exactly who these people were. They wrote. They wrote a great deal. They wrote what we call Linear A documents. We don't know the language. It's not Greek, we know that, but it isn't any other known language. Now, I mentioned in the last lecture, you may recall, that today scholars tend to classify people, to organize people by language groupings. So we've got a real problem with the Minoans. We don't know what group to put them in. So we can't give them a history. We can't even give them much of a past, to tell you the truth. We just don't know a lot about them. Now,